you could start by telling me something about your background and when you were born and where you were born.
I was born in Birmingham in 1931, and to Birmingham, well, both my parents were Birmingham bred and born, and my father was a toolmaker at a small engineering firm in the west, you know, in Birmingham.
Whereabouts in Birmingham?
In Yardley, which is, you know, a few miles from here, like, you know, a matter of 5-6 miles from here. I had one brother and two sisters, and that's, you know, that was the scope of my family. My father had been in the 14-18 war, you know, in the Guards, and my brother went in the army when his turn came, when he was, when the 39-45 war. And I went to school, and I left school just as the war was ending, about 1945. I was 14 years of age. And I virtually went straight into the car trade. I worked at the Metropolitan Camel Carriage, which was a coach building firm.
How did you get a job there? And why there?
Oh, well, I did it from school. Then there was plenty of jobs about, and the school used to. I was good at woodwork and things like that. And I had various jobs to pick from. You could pick jobs. There were hundreds. You could get as many as you wanted, you know. Mm. And you had an interview before you left school, and with the headmaster of the school, and they sorted you out to what your education ability was. And I went to the Metropolitan Camel Carriage. And I worked there for about 2.5 years. And then they used to pay lower wages there than they did in the car firm. And then the car firms were just coming up, you know, to start. They just, the war had ended then, and they just started building cars.
Yes, yes.
And I went to Molyneux. That was a small coach building and car. They used to do contract work for the big car companies. And I worked there for a few years, about 2 years, 3 years.
What did you do there? What sort of work?
I worked on the cars, bodywork, anything that they give you to do. I used to work on the, we had a contract for the Alvis cars. There was a car called the Alvis, and we had a small contract for them, and the Armstrong Siddeley, that was another British car. And I worked there on the Armstrong Siddeley. We used to do the bodies and make up the sliding roofs. There used to be metal sliding roofs in the cars then. And we used to make the wooden frame. There was a lot of wood in the cars then.
Yes.
And we used to make the framework up, and then the men, the panel beaters, would panel them and linish them down. And you used to have jobs like that. Small jobs, you know. You used to build yourself up like that. They'd give you a small job to do, and then you'd go on to that.
You weren't apprenticed in any way?
No.
Why not? Was it too expensive?
Well, no, I could have had an apprenticeship. I wanted to go in the army when I was 18. Like I told you, my father was in the Coldstream Guards. My brother was in the army. All my uncles had been in the 14-18 war. Some of them buried there, you know, were killed on the Somme. And I'd got this thing about going in the army. Mm. And I knew that if I took an apprenticeship, which I should have done, but I wanted to go in the army, which I did. And that's where I got off on the wrong foot. I should have listened to my father, and
yes,
that was it. Anyway, I went in the army then at 18. And I came out, I was about, just turned 20. I went in for 18 months, and then the Korea War broke out.
Yes.
So I had to do 2 years and about 3 months. You know, you got what they call a king's pleasure. In other words, they let you out when they were ready to let you out. So I did about 2 years and 3 months. And I came out, and I went back to another coach building firm called Frank Grounds. They used to do commercial bodywork. It was a one-off. They'd build a station wagon or a mobile home or caravans. They used to make mobile fish and chip shops, things like that. And that was very skilled work. It was really hard to do. Nothing like the car trade. And there was, they were all wood, sir. And I had a spell when I worked at the Met. I'd had 2 years, or 2.5 years, at a technical college. Mm-hmm. And I had virtually done the same thing as an apprentice would, like, you know. And what we were called improvers. I hadn't sent Sammy indentures or anything. But
no.
We had this training. Mm. And I went there when I came out of the army. I worked there. I used to go overnight in my own time, about 3 nights a week. And we used to do woodwork, technical drawing, cabinet making more, you know. But once you learn how to use wood, you could turn it to coachwork or anything. And then I worked there till I was about 22 or 23. And they went short of work. Well, what they used to do, they used to get rid of all the single lads, you know, all the single fellas. They took it easy on the married ones with families, mm. if they could. And they used to stop all the single fellas. So I was out of work for about a week, and I was in the union. By this time, I joined the union at 15.
And at the Met.
At the Metropolitan Camel Carriage, I joined the union, and they were the ones who obviously sent me to school. They used to make the company send you to school. I had one day of work at this technical school. Oh. And I used to work 4 days. And on a Friday, I used to go to this technical college. I'm going off the subject a bit.
So you had a union card?
Oh, yeah, I had a union card from when I was 15. 1947, I joined the union. April 47.
What, Saltley Branch?
Yes, Saltley Branch, at the National Union of Vehicle Builders, it was then, because there was all these different unions there. And anyway, as I say, I came out of the army, went back to Frank Brown's, and then they went short of work. So we used to go up the union office, and they said, oh, we try the different places, go down the Austin at Longbridge. So I went down the Austin, and I got a job in the body shop. I had a card, my union card said that I was a finisher. That was the finishing of the vehicle, not the stuff. But if you went down there and there was a body job, you just took it if you could get it, you know. So I went in the body shop there, and I was only there a few weeks, matter of a month. And there was a damn great strike started. And if you know anything about
it. Oh, I know that strike.
It was over a man called McHugh. And anyway, I got mixed up in that. I was only there 4 weeks. And I was on strike for 16 weeks. I'd only been working in the factory for, I didn't even know the damned El McHugh was. But I just got a gut job there.
Yes, you
and that was about something like 1953.
Yes.
And 53. They just started making the Austin A30, the little Austin A30. It was the first all-metal body. There was no wood in it at all. It was all metal. Anyway, I got mixed up in that one. And after 16 weeks, it collapsed. The managing director was somebody called Leonard Lord.
Yes.
And he broke the National Union of Vehicle Builders. That strike went on for 16 weeks, but it finished the union off because they were paying strike payout. But I also think it very likely broke the Austin Motor Company and all. And anyway, I didn't go back.
What did you live on? Those 16 weeks.
Well, I was single then, and my father was I was a single man, and my father got a good job, and he didn't agree with what I was doing, because he wasn't in the union, so he was never in the union, and he said I was a fool. But at the time, obviously, I'd only been there a month, but I thought I was doing the right thing, you know, sticking up for our rights and that. And then I've got different views now, but at that time, I thought I was right.
Yes.
Anyway, we left, I could have gone, I was offered to go back after the strike, because obviously they knew that I was an innocent bystander, sort of thing. I'd only been there 4 weeks. And I was young anyway, and they wanted young people there. But I never went back, and I went from there to the Jaguar Cars at Coventry. And I worked there for about 2 or 3 years, on the SK150, the Mark 7. The saloon, and the SK120. Mm. I told you I was there when they won the Le Mans.
Yes.
And that I worked there for 2 or 3 years.
In the body shop?
No, in the finishing shop. I was on the right on the end of the track. I'd gone back to my job I was virtually trying for.
Yes.
There used to be a lot of wood in the Jaguar cars because they were quite an expensive car. They weren't the run-of-the-mill thing like the A30. They were really expensive cars there. And I worked on the sports cars. And with the training I'd had at Frank Grounds and that, I could do jobs, you know, and I was dead keen because I loved working on cars. And I was dead keen, obviously, and I was only 20-something. I'd only be 25 then.
Mm.
And we used to get our special jobs. And while I was there, funny enough, we had a job. They built a Mark 7 Jag for Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands. She had a Jaguar. And the film stars used to have them. There was Clark Gable, he had two SK-150s, and Sonja Heaney, the ice skater, she had one. And I used to get the jobs, I used to put the seats in and door casings and some of the woodwork. And it was quite an interesting job.
So you might spend days on one job?
Oh, not days, you wouldn't spend days, but they were that meticulous on the work, it was that when you got one of these special cars, you'd have to go and wash your hands. Some of the colours they had in the cars, they were that light. What was the one, Sanja Heaney? Orchid blue. Everything inside, the seats, the carpets were all orchid blue. If you just touch them with your hands, you're dirtied. So you have to go in the toilet and wash your hands.
So one-off jobs often?
Oh yeah, you get a one-off. Job. You know, like when they did this one for the Queen of Holland. It was a one-off. She'd got cloth trimming. Now, at the time, there was no cloth trimming cars. They used to use leather and hide. But when she had that one, it was cloth, you know, three-pair suites of made uncut moquette, I suppose it was. And it was quite interesting. You took a pride in your work. You can imagine, you know, they did one for a Texas Oil millionaire. And all the chrome work on it, instead of it being chrome, it was gold plated. And we used to have the screws and cup washers that held the door casings. The door casings were all screwed on with screws and cup washers. And they were all gold plated, you know. The foreman used to count them out and all the bumper bars were gold plated. That was only a one-off. And it was for a Texas Oil millionaire. And of course it was, obviously it was interesting, and when you'd finished it and you think, by God, I've had something to do with that. And it was something to be proud of, you know, because you used to have to watch what you was doing.
How did they pay you? Because it was all piecework, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was piecework. By this time there was almost a standard rate. The finishers used to get the ice right, and then there was trimmers. They were perhaps a penny or twopence an hour less. Then there was body makers, they'd be perhaps the same as finishers or a bit less. There was about four rates, and that was what they called chassis line workers. So there were four different rates then. There was more than that, but on an average,
you were on the top
on the
already.
Track.
Mm.
So if you were a finisher and you were doing this mucking about with the polished woodwork and that, you got a little bit extra. And I lived in Birmingham then, in Yardley, and I used to travel to Coventry on a motorbike. I had an aerial motorbike, and it was about 16 mile to Coventry.
Yes, yes.
There, and 16 mile back, like 34 mile a day I was travelling. And they got plenty of work. And I worked there for, perhaps 3 years, something like that, 2.5, 3 years.
Were there other Birmingham people?
Oh, yes. I went on from that. I sold my motorbike and got a car, and I used to take three fellas to work in my car, and they used to pay me and used to take them backwards and forwards to work.
But that was, I think, 1-7 rate.
That's right, it was a 1-7 rate then. That's what a finisher got then. He got the old coach builder's rate of 1-7.
Yes.
You seem to know more about it. That's right.
Not a certain thing.
Yeah.
Now, were there any old Rover people there at Jaguar, or not that you came across?
Well, I wouldn't have known, you know.
No.
But possibly, because they all used to move about. There was Met people, Austin, they used to move where the work was.
Skills
They'd move where the work was. And it was a fairly skilled job then. And you couldn't do it, you didn't do anything wrong. If you did your job wrong, you went down the front of the track and put it right. You know, the inspector would pick it up and you were expected to go down and put it right. So obviously you didn't do it wrong in the first place. Why, where you got your position on the track?
No.
You'd do your job within reason, you'd do it right. And as I say, I worked there for 3 years and I give me noticing and they weren't very pleased.
Why was that?
Well, the Jaguar at the time would very likely be the poorest paid place in Coventry at that time, because there was a Standard and they all, and what was else was there? Fisher and Ludlows, Fishers anyway.
Roots was there.
Roots were there and they all paid more money than the Jaguar. I think the Standard was the highest paid place of the lot, when Standard or Roots.
Yes, yes.
Well, the Jaguar was the lowest paid. So obviously, like, if they got a good fella and he was a good timekeeper and they didn't want to lose him. And I'd got fed up with the travelling more than anything. And my dad had been getting on to me. He'd keep saying, you going from place to place. You say you want to settle down somewhere? Because my father had worked at a firm for about 34 years, you know, he'd never move. And of course I used to think he was a bit of a stick in the mud. And I was getting the money, every place I went to, I got good money. I know that.
What sort of, do you remember?
Oh yeah, when I worked at the Jaguar, I was getting about, they used to have an habit of paying you out in guineas then. You'd get 16 guineas, that was £16.16. Well, that'd be about 1950, between 53 and 55, or 52 and 55. And I was,
yes,
on that average, I was getting about 16 guineas a week. Well, say £16, and all the overtime I did. Some nights I'd work till 8 o'clock at night, you know. And I was getting good money.
Yes.
My father, as I say, is a toolmaker. I'd go home with more money, much more money. He'd be getting about £11 then. I was still £5 or £6 or £7 a week.
Yes.
More than he was getting as a skilled toolmaker. And I was single and he was bringing, well, he wasn't bringing our family up because they were old.
Yes,
I was the youngest in the family. But he could see what I was earning.
Yes.
And I mean, he was a really skilled toolmaker. And that was it. We were the kings, you know. We were getting more money. And as I say,
where did he work? Sorry,
my father. He worked for a small firm called Pollard's Bearings on the Tyburn Road. It was they used to make roller bearings. But he worked. He was about 72 when he finished work, I think he was, because they couldn't get skilled men. He'd gone to the BSA funny enough, but to Macadam Lane, and he finished about his last years of his life. There, he worked there for about 9 years, but virtually since he came out of the army, he'd worked at this one small place.
Just, yes.
Which was a very small company, employed perhaps 100 men, I doubt if that. And anyway, back to the story, I was at the Jag, and then I left, applied for a job at the Rover Company at Solihull. Had an interview, then the superintendent used to interview, a man called Les Barras was the superintendent, who interviewed me. And he asked me what I'd done at the Jag and different places. And he said, well, we're starting men up, and we'll start you up in about a fortnight's time. And I went back to the Jag, and within a fortnight, they'd sent me a letter from the Rover, and I'd give me notice in at the Jag and left. And went the Rover. That then was 1955.
How had you heard about the Rover?
Well, my brother worked there. But, you know, the different people used to work with. But my brother was working there then.
Ah, yeah, so you knew the way.
And he said they wanted men at the Rover, so he used to. And I got, like we said, I got my union card. And on my union card, the superintendent, no, by union card, got finisher on it. Because union cards weren't easy to come by. By then, you'd got to add a certain amount of training. You didn't get a union card easy. And if you got a union card, it wouldn't have had finisher on it. Because like we said, I had this old coach building right from when I'd worked at the Metropolitan Camel Carriage. Anyway, that was it, 1955. I went to the Rover.
Do you remember what you started at?
Oh, yeah. I started on the, it was called, God in heaven.
My goodness.
I started on, is that still on?
No, that's all right. I'll just,
come and have something to run for. Switch it off.
My goodness, thank you very much.
Started at the Rover in 1955. And the car I was working on was called a P4. The Rover P4. That was the Rover 90, the 75, and the Rover 60. Those were the different sizes, the engine sizes.
Yes.
It was the same body, but they were different engine sizes. And I worked on that for about 4 years. And then they brought out the Rover, what they used to call the Rover P5. That was the next model after the P4. That was an expensive car. Again, they did two. They did a saloon and one what they call a coupe. They were both four-door cars, but one was a saloon and one was a coupe. And I worked on that for 16 years, right from when it started. I had 8 months in a virtual, a little experimental shop, when it was in its prototype. And I don't know if it was picked out, I don't know. But anyway, I was on the track on the P4 one day and they put me on this new model and I was working in this little shop. And I worked, as I say, 8 months on the prototype and then I worked on it till it virtually finished. And that was a long, how long ago was that? I've been on the Range Rover 10 years.
Wasn't it 72?
Yeah, it'd be 72 or 73. It finished.
A 3.5 litre, wasn't it?
Yes.
3 litre.
Well, it started, the Rover engine was in it to start with, the old Rover engine, and then they bought the rights off General Motors and they put that American V8 in it. And as I say, I worked, that was the longest spell I ever had on a car, in the car industry. And it was 16 years. And as I say, I went on it when it started and I've seen the last one go off the end of our track 16 years later. And then I went on to the Range Rover, which I've been on now 11 years, taking me up to my 28 years service in the company.
And your gold watch.
Oh, my gold watch, yeah. Well, it started off as a shell, the way end of the track.
That's right, yes.
And it comes all the way round. It goes down and it's got the engine put in it and the chassis.
Yes, yes.
And then the seats and the finishing and the trim and the carpet start to go into it. And when it comes off the other end of the line, it's finished.
I'm going out now, Dad. All right, so bye-bye. Bye. Good luck with your book. It's a nice meeting you.
Yes, bye.
Okay, then I'll be back later.
Enjoy your holiday.
Bye.
Bye.
But it's not virtually like that. That was the person who run the Ford Motor Company, what was his name?
Yes.
He made it like that. But
Henry Ford,
but it wasn't like that at the Rover. What had happened, they used to have a main assembly line and what they used to call a finishing line. Well, the car had come round this main assembly line and it was virtually 90% finished when it come off the track. But there was always shortages or something went wrong with the car, you know. But mainly shortages. And it used to go from the main assembly line to what they call the finishing area where it was spivved up, if that's the word. If there was anything wrong with it, a damaged paintwork, or it was then put right and then it went into sales. But go on, Paul, help yourself. What used to happen? You know, you're going on about these strikes.
But first tell me about how the assembly line wasn't like.
Well, it wasn't.
Henry Ford.
It wasn't how Henry Ford used to put a chassis on the one end of the line. And when it came off the other end, it was finished. Now, they used to do this at the Austin. They'd put the car on one end, and Leonard Lord, that was the managing director then, when it came off the other end, it was finished. And if there was anything wrong with it, it didn't make any difference, because he used to say, we can sell anything. I mean, like I've told you, the British had the run of the car trade. Every other country had been flattened during the war.
Yeah.
And there was only Britain and America virtually building cars. So there was a waiting list for cars. You couldn't get a Morris Minor car for love nor money. there was an 18 months waiting list. If you could have got hold of a little Morris Minor, you could have made £200 or £300 on your profit, because people would buy them off you more than they were fetching, you know, new.
Yes, yes.
So, as I say, we had the run of the car trade, and they used to just make the cars on the track off the other end, and that was it. They went in into the out of the factory and into the showroom sort of thing. But as things got tighter, they used to have to take more trouble with them, you know. But I'm going off it a bit.
Yeah, this the Rover, what was that?
Well, the Rover wasn't...
You didn't have one line
didn't have one line, no. Sir. And the cars used to go off the main assembly line.
Yes.
Into the finishing shop, as we call it. But they used to be coming off the main assembly line, 10 to the dozen. But they'd go out on the car parks because they got to go into this other shop to be finished. And that wasn't virtually a track, it was where they put them right. So what you used to do, you used to have a bottleneck all the time.
Yes.
You'd have hundreds of cars out the car park.
All the jobs came through the finishing, didn't they?
And then they weren't finished, so they'd either got shortages on thing, or something was damaged, or something was wrong with the gearbox, or they got a brake leaking, and you'd end up.
What about customer specifications? Like, these Rover cars were still partly customer, you know.
Not so much. No. There were things on them, but they weren't so much. They were virtually. They were an expensive car, but they weren't like
Jaguars.
They did get one of.
Yes. Not like this.
Not
Jaguars.
Like that. No.
No.
But and as I say, all these cars used to pile up out on the car park. So within a matter of a couple of months, you'd very likely have 200 or 300 or 400 or 500 cars out on the compound unfinished. And this is where this thing, I believe, this is my belief.
Yes.
Is a lot of these strikes.
Yes.
Were caused.
How?
Well, you'd got all these cars piled up out on the car park, and the management had got to get them finished and into sales. So what they used to do, this is only my theory.
No.
This is my theory. They used to upset the men one way or another on the main assembly lines, get them to go out on strike. You go out on strike for a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, and they clear the cars up soon, and then they get you back to work again.
Because the finishing shop would be working.
The finishing shop would work, sir, and clear them up.
Yes.
And all the old hands at the Rover will tell you this tale if you get in.
I have heard the
expression,
you always kept an eye on the car park.
That's right. That's true. As soon as the car's back, the old hands, those men older than me, and they used to say, get ready for it. And they used to upset the stewards somehow. Or they'd take the bonus off us. We used to work on a bonus system then. There was none of this measured day work then. Well, all they'd got to do was bring the bonus figures out a bit low. And the men used to hit the roof.
Be met,
and
then
out they'd go, sir.
Yes.
And I've always had this at the back of my mind. I'm positive of it now, you know. You can only go on so many years, and it used to happen year after day, month after month, year after year, and you get this pattern after a time. And that's what a lot of the strikes were caused about. Obviously, some of them money and different things.
So the finishing line wasn't affected? Like you used to work more or less 12 months a year?
Oh, yes.
Or was there still that seasonal fluctuation?
No, not then. The seasonal fluctuation used to be the strikes that you caused. That'd make you lose time. But if you took a man's earnings in the finishing shop where they went into sales and mine on the main assembly, you'd see a great discrepancy in the wages. You'll even see that now on the Range Rover. Some parts of the company work 7 days a week even now. The mini paint shops and these areas. If you look at the men's wages there, you'll see at least £1,000 more than a man who works in there, or even more than that. I'll go as far as to say £2,000. He'd earn more, £2,000 a year more, and of course that brought a lot of aggro and all, because when a man could earn £20 a week more than you, with no problem, virtually doing the same job, this. You know, brought a lot of bad feeling around.
What was the union quite strong when you came in?
Yes, it was. But yes, because obviously there was plenty of work about. It was very strong. And my belief, it had gone very political by then.
Already by then?
No, I reckon in 1953 it started to go political. I reckon that strike at the Austin...
Oh, the McHugh.
...was a political strike. They'd started to show their head. And as the years went on, it was obvious they weren't all over into... I think the union went away from the working man. They'd gone into politics. Instead of worrying about his wages and his pension, I worked for 16 years at the Rover, and I used to pay... While I was on the P5, that 16 years was virtually wasted with my pension. I used to pay half a crown a week into the pension fund. At the end of 16 years, I'd got £97 a year coming pension. I'd paid nothing into it. But no. You only get out what you pay in, and the company paid nothing, virtually nothing for me. So after 16 years of the company, I can show the thing upstairs now, I've got £97 a year pension to come.
Yeah,
and this is where the union fell down. All they were moaning, wanted to do was tell the governments what to do instead of worrying about our pensions, our wages. And in this time, this is why we've slipped behind. And they're doing it in every industry. They spare the miners of the same. I don't know, but they've all gone into politics instead of worrying about the working man and what conditions he was working under and his pension and his wages. They've gone off the straight and narrow. As I say, they've gone into politics.
There was also, when you just came to the Rover, there was a big strike, wasn't there? Or they tried to... There was a layoff.
Oh, yeah.
And there were about... because you said it was political, and they had meetings, and the men refused what the union wanted them to do, which was to stay out.
Oh, that was recently, though, that was when...
No, that was like... I mean, probably because it's so long ago, but I read the newspapers. And in 1956, they tried to lay off 120 people, make them redundant on the cars.
That's right, and yes, that's true.
And there was Fred Barker, I think, he was...
Ted Barker.
He was the convener.
Yes, that's right.
And they wanted you all to come out, and there was a meeting, and they more or less defeated what the union wanted.
Yes, that's true.
Because you just went back to work.
Yes, the car side had gone short, because the Suez crisis had brought
it
on. Petrol went on the rationing. And
that's correct, isn't it? That you didn't really stay out. Maybe you stayed out
for a week or... Because it wasn't that. That's true, yeah. And then... That was about the time I think the P6 was coming in. The Rover 2000. They built that new factory for the Rover 2000.
No, that's later, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And yes, that's true. The Land Rover was still... Obviously, because they were building army vehicles, they were fighting vehicles. So the Land Rover, I think they outvoted the car side anyway, and they went back to work. But it was only a... That wasn't a strike. It might have lasted 3 days or four days. The longest strike I can remember at the Rover is about 4 years ago, when Michael Edwards took over. I think that only lasted 9 days. 10 days, that was the longest strike of it. There was lots of flare-ups, 2 days and 3 days, but never a prolonged one. Not like the Austin or some of the strikes. The Metropolitan, they had a long strike for about 14 weeks.
When you were there?
No.
Oh, much later.
Much later.
Oh, take
one
of these.
Yes.
A bit better than the club, probably. So when you were on the piecework first, and of course you did a lot of overtime, because of the finishing and on the high rate, and as you said, layoffs didn't affect you in the same way as probably assembly workers.
That's true. That's how it was. Like, you know, the 1 hour would be working virtually overtime, and the main assembly line would be laid off. Either they'd They'd gone on strike for a couple of days or they were laid off.
Did you, so your wages went up from the 16 guineas at the Jaguar quite a bit, I suppose, or?
No, it was virtually at the same time. Like the Jaguar was paying it about the same as the Rover. It just went up over the years. I got some wage slips at the time that go back about 10 or 15 years. At work in my locker still. You could get a...
Yes, because I was just thinking
them off me, yeah.
To get a sort of systematic... Mm-hmm. You know, just an example of how wages...
Well, I've got some old wage slips, I know. I'll tell you what they are now, obviously. Well, you already know they're £123 a week now, because we've gone on to this, we're still on this measured day work. And we were still getting reasonably good wages, as I say, 10 years ago. It was when the measure, well, I think when they went started to go, is when the Leyland took over. When British Leyland were made, it started off at the British Motor Corporation, the Austin took over.
1968, yes.
And then...
did you notice anything of that then?
At the time, no. It's
no,
funny.
I didn't think...
No, you didn't, you know.
The management was the same. Everyone was the same then, wasn't it?
Oh, sorry, yes, I did notice. You mean when the Leyland took over? Oh, yes, I did. I've seen a big change then. What happened? They brought this measured day work in. But all the old Rover management, obviously, they went.
But that took a few years, that's what I meant.
Yeah, the directors and them, they made a lot of money. They sold the government, give them the Labour government, give them the money, and they bought them all out virtually. They got one share or two shares for everyone they held. So some of the big people went out with a fortune, obviously. Mm. And, of course, all the employees had shares at the Rover and the... Has anybody mentioned that to you?
Yes. Not everyone had them, though.
I've got them now.
Did you get the maximum? Could have, like, 500
you could have,
or something.
You had them. They used to sell them at £50. And for £50, you got 200 shares. There were 5 shillings each then. And all the companies used to do this, I believe the Austin did and the Morris. I suppose the Jaguar did, but you'd got to work at the company 3 years before you were offered them. And most of the sensible chaps and the older ones, as soon as they come up, they bought those shares. And then when you've been there so many years, you know, perhaps another 2 or 3 years, they give it another £50 worth. And then you went on like that and you could get a maximum. I think the maximum was about £200 worth. And then, this was at the time, of course, when the Leyland took over, and then all that stopped. But they paid you this money out, they changed the shares, and I've still got them now.
You benefited too, didn't you?
Because for every one share, I think we had, or every two we got, they give us one. So, like, if you got a couple of £100 worth, your 200 ended up at 600 and something pound you'd got, because they made them, took them from a 5 shilling share and made them a pound share. So we benefited that way. So your £200 you'd invested and very likely been having a dividend on it for God knows how long, ended up, I think it was about £666 you'd got for £200. And, you know, that was quite good. And I think it was a good thing, and all because you got a lot of people. There's a hell of a lot of people at the Rover out there. And you felt involved with the company. You know what I mean? All right, you might have got 15 or £20, something, every 6 months. Once in September and once in March, like that was the two payouts for the shareholders. But at least you felt a part of that company.
Yes, right.
And there was a hell of a lot, as I say, a lot of people out there. They hadn't used to tell you, but you learnt over the years that, you know, they'd let little things out and you think, well, he's got the Rover shares, but there must have been... I think I read one time in one of the things like you're doing now, somebody writ up a report, and I couldn't say I'd be positive, but I'm sure that they added them all together, people who got shares at the Austin and Morris and the Jaguar perhaps and the Rover. And I'm sure that the employee shares came to about £80 million. You know, before the...
Yes.
I don't know, obviously they're still there now, but they took the vote. You could go and to a shareholders meeting.
Yes,
if you wanted to. Well,
what happened?
I had never used to go, but you could do if you wanted to. They used to have a shareholders meeting in the Rover Company.
And did you have the same
You had
rights?
A card. Yes, you had. You could
As
get
an
up, say you. Yes,
right.
If you held shares. They were called employee shares, but you could go in the share. You used to have your dividend come, and you got a voting slip on. Well, obviously, most of us, we just used to. If there was anything to vote on, we wouldn't even bother. I used to put mine back in the post, and I wouldn't bother. Like, no, I never went to a shareholders meeting. Never once. All the time I held them. But there were people who did. One man went in there who used to win. He kicked up a rumpus. He said something, and before, you very likely heard this, they got the press down there and God knows what. I think this was a thing that the company didn't, when the Leyland took over, I think they took this into consideration. It was a way a man could express himself if he wanted to.
Yes, yes.
He could, perhaps didn't realise it at the time when you were buying the shares, but as I got older I realised that if I wanted to, and I wanted to get more involved in the company, I could have put some more money in there, and I could have gone to one of these shareholders meetings. But when Stokes took over, he stopped it. He didn't get a vote, so obviously there was no share. Anyway, the company, just after that, had virtually gone bankrupt. The government was putting all the money in it, so the ordinary working man, or all the little shareholders around they couldn't have a say anyway, because their money had gone. The shares had gone then from about £1 down to something like, I think they went to as low as 19p from £1, so virtually the shares were like confetti, they weren't worth the paper they were written. But I think this was a sad thing when they stopped those.
But yet you never used it really?
No.
Possibility?
Like. No, because virtually I didn't know that I knew I could go, but you know,
yes.
I didn't know virtually I could have gone in there and
yes.
Said me piece if I wanted to about something, but you know, you didn't bother. Well, not didn't bother at the time. I just didn't realise what I had got in my hand if I'd wanted to do it.
Yes.
And you realise as you get older, obviously.
Yes.
And anyway, by then it had gone. As I say, it was all squashed. But I think that was a very bad thing when they squashed those shares, because men used to get involved with the company, and you thought that you was virtually a little bit part of that company. And another thing is, you were more less liable not to go on strike, because if it was only a few hundred pound, it was a few hundred pound you'd got in that company. And as I say, I think it was a sorry day when they did away with those shit.
Most of the people where you worked.
Oh yes. Most of the old hands would have them. You could go around. I'm not an auditor. You could go on our section now, and there's perhaps 20 men on the door section, old hands. And
yes,
I bet if you went round, there'd be 10 of them, nearly half of them who'd got shares in the Light Rover.
You still have them?
I've still got mine now, yeah.
Are they profitable? I mean, what's that?
You get 7.5% off them. You get a 7.5 for every £100. You've got £7.50 in every 100, and then you pay tax on them. Not really.
Yeah, that's.
But the way inflation's coming down, it's almost as good as the building society again now.
Yeah, so that's good.
But at the time, like 7.5% was good. My mortgage then, when I had those shares, I was getting 7.5% off. My mortgage was only 4.5%. I was only paying 4.5% mortgage. To the I had my mortgage to them.
This is 11 years ago, you said?
No.
No, this is.
No, and 20 years ago. I had my mortgage to the municipal bank, and they used to have, once you'd signed it, it didn't go up. They couldn't put your mortgage up. You paid it at that rate, so. Well, I got a couple of hundred pounds invested in the Rover Company, and I was getting 7.5% before tax. I've got to pay tax on it. But my mortgage was only 4.5%. So, you know, at the time, it wasn't a bad investment.
No.
And then we had this extra money given. I've had those shares. I don't know how long. Well, I've been there 28 years, so I've had the shares 25. I started buying shares about 25. You'd got to be there 3 years, yes, I think it was, yes, to get them. So virtually, I've had them shares now for 25. I was buying shares 25 years ago. And that's one part that I really thought was good, you know.
Mm.
And it did something that did. I was, and I think a lot of companies did it, you know. I think it was a real sorry day when that lot packed up.
By the time you were, just to catch up on your personal life, by the time you came to the Rover, were you already married then?
No, I wasn't married.
I just make sure that's all right. Yes. When did you get?
I got married 23 years ago, so I was
1960.
30. 1960. About 1960, yeah, about 1960 I got married. And as I say, I was working at the Rover on the P5, it had just started, thereabout. 58 the P5 started, I'd been on it 2 or 3 years. And I was getting good money then.
So what did you spend? You paid your mother at home or something, what did you do?
Oh, I paid, you know, I used to pay my mother fairly good money too, but I was, then I'd be on, I must have been on 25 or perhaps more than that, £25 a week or more than that then. Well, houses then, you could buy a new house for £2,000. You could buy a semi-detached house. My first semi-detached house was £2,300. And I bought it before I got married. My wife was,
yes,
at work.
Yes.
And I virtually found this where I used to live in Yardley. And I put my deposit on this plot of land. I think I put £25 in or £50. And they built the house, which took 12 months to build. And I bought that house for £2,375. A brand new semi, a good one, a really nice big semi-detached house.
Hmm.
And I got it with the municipal bank at 4.5%, with a bit of struggle at the Rover, because obviously they used to check up on you, and I'd worked at the Rover quite a few years then, so the bank obviously checked up on that. Anyway, I saved £800 deposit. So I borrowed virtually £1,600, I only borrowed £1,600. But that was a lot of money then to borrow. It might sound silly to you now. But it was quite a bit of money. And because I worked in the car trade, it was very flexible. They'd give a man who was perhaps a postman, earning £12 a week, they were more liable to give him a mortgage than they would me, earning £25, because our job was so...
Because of the resiliency.
The strikes and God knows what, sir. It all went against you, really. Well, anyway, they lent me this money, and I bought that house. And within 5 years of living in it, my wife went to work as well. I didn't do it on my own. She'd got a job. And she worked in a components firm that made car parts, Wilmot and Bruton.
Wilmot, oh,
well,
yes.
Girlings, sorry. She worked for Girlings most of the time.
In Tarsley.
Yeah, in Tarsley. She worked there. So, like, between the two of us, within 5 years, we bought this house, and I paid for it, and I can even tell you how much I was quite, I would always use my common sense with money. I was very practical. I paid for the house in 5 years, and I borrowed £1,600, and I only had to pay £232 interest. So I borrowed £1,600. And I paid back £1,832. That was the whole 5 years interest. Because I paid it back so fast.
Yes, yes.
Because of then the good wages I was earning. So I sold it then. Oh, and we hadn't got any children. My wife, we'd been married 5 years before we had Debbie. Then my wife had our first child. I'd been after 6 years. So I'd got a house then paid for. And I was only 35 years old myself. So we sold it, and I sold it for twice as much as I bought it for. So instead of having some of 2,500, I was talking about 4,500. I sold the house and I bought a bungalow for £4,500. Cash, the bungalow cost £4,500. And I bought it cash without getting into debt, so. And we got one child by then. I stopped in the bungalow. 5 and 6 years, and I sold it again, and I doubled my money again. I got 8,250 pounds for my bungalow, and I bought this house, and that's how I got this house here.
And you also bought that straight, or did you?
No, when because I came here, no.
It's tax, it has advantages, doesn't it, to have a mortgage, really?
Well, it is if you're sure of good and what work money you're earning. But by this time, I moved in this house 11 years ago, and then I had to take another mortgage house for £2,000. And by this time, our money had really started to slide. And this
already?
Yes, 11 years ago, the money... We'd gone into... By this time, Leyland had took over, and it had virtually been nationalised. The shares were worth nothing all 12 months after it. So our money had started, and we'd gone into this measured day work then. So our money had started to drop then. And everybody else was overtaking us. And I'd moved in here, and I took on a £2,000 mortgage again, which virtually is nothing.
No.
But by God, I struggled. I know it sounds silly. I'd got two children.
Yeah.
And our money had gone down, and we were losing time then through strikes and God knows what. I came off the... It was just the time that I came off the P5 onto the Land Rover.
The Range Rover.
And this measured day weight was in, and we got in a lot of trouble then. They wouldn't accept us. They wouldn't accept the car workers on the Range Rover because they got paid a lower rate than we did. We'd still got the old coach builder's rate.
Oh, yes.
And it was in the same time.
Seven.
Yeah. We'd still got this 1-7 rate. And the Range Rover hadn't. It was classed as a semi-skilled job.
Like Land Rover,
sir. They got the same rate as Land Rover. So when I came over off the P5, after about... How long had I worked there then?
Is that 16 years?
About 16, right?
Yes.
18 years, about 18 years.
Yes,
I goes over on the Range Rover, and they wouldn't accept us on the job. And these men who wouldn't accept us, some of them had only worked at the company 12 months.
Yeah, I was just...
They were dustmen and postmen, and they'd all come into the industry, sir. And they wouldn't have the old Rover workers working on the... Because of our rate, we got paid about £2 or £3 a week more. I think it was £2. We got two. So the first day I walked on the Range Rover, me and this fella that I was moved over, we were moved over as our job finished. And as we walked over on the Range Rover, they all went on strike. They moved me and this fella, Joe Clements, he'd worked there at the Rover longer than me. And we walked in and we couldn't have a proper job. They give us odd things to do because of the rate. Anyway, they put me on working on the sub-assembly where I work now, on the door section. And as soon as I started to work on the door, I was doing Reggie Felton's job. He was a steward at the time. He was senior steward. And he was getting this measured day work. He was one who was on the committee bringing it in.
Yes.
So they put me on his job because he worked on the sub-assembly on the door section. And... as I say, that caused a downer for God knows how long. And that caused quite a bit of trouble, the rate, and then they settled that.
What did they do? How did they settle it? Did they bring it up? Or?
They brought them up to us somehow, I think. They used to get the 1-7, but only on the day rate. I think we were only paid £2 a week, I think it was more. Anyway, they evened it out somehow. And then they accepted us on the section. And this was all about the time as the measured day
work
coming.
It's interesting that they didn't bring you down when you moved to Rome.
Well, a lot of them, they did. Some of them did. They put me on a job what was classed as an all right. Some of the other ones did. They lost the rate, so they came down to this 1-6 rate. And that caused a lot of bad feeling, obviously. They'd been on the higher rate, and then they lost it. They only lost a couple of pounds, but I think it hurt the pride more than anything.
Yes.
And that caused a hell of a lot of trouble.
What about progression system? Wasn't that introduced?
Oh, God, yeah.
Then?
That was in then, yeah.
Because
that
I
was
know
a right mess up.
Was also associated with that.
I used to do this progressive system where you moved off a job and got on another job, which was perhaps all this rate that we're on about. But that caused a hell of a load of trouble. You were getting men swapping the jobs all the time.
Did that affect you? Well, not really.
No, not really, because I've for this 11 years I've been on this one job virtually. But
was
I think
it only
caused
on the tracks?
Pardon?
Was that only on the tracks?
No, the sub-assembly did, it was all this 1 and 7, most of the jobs were this 1 and 7, right? So, virtually, like you say, we didn't come into it.
No, no, once you're at the top, of course, it doesn't
that
matter.
Was it. No, you but couldn't lose it. Like, if they put you on a job that was 1 and 5, you were all right because you held the 1 and 7 this higher, right? But it must have caused the management some headaches because where a man was getting used to it, doing a certain part of the car, he'd get this progressive system and he'd move off his job and somebody else would go on it. And by this time they got, as I say, they got everybody coming in. You could get a union card there, like anybody could get one.
But he wouldn't have finisher on it, of course.
Oh no, he might, he'd have semi-skilled or something.
Yes,
and then they'd go, they'd get finisher on it by going through this, I don't know as they did, perhaps they didn't get it on, but it was all counted them as semi-skilled work anyway. Most of us. My card now is still got, I'm semi-skilled now. On my union card to be semi-skilled.
It wouldn't not have finishers.
It wouldn't have finisher on it now, no. I mean, because I've gone into another union as well. I'm in the Transport and General Workers Union now, not in the National Union of Vehicle Builders. They were taken over, you know. So it was one big union, or a lot of the little unions fell by the wayside then.
That all happened at the same time?
About in the 11 years of the measured day work when Lord Stokes till the present time.
And what did you feel about that? Were you involved in the union at all at the Rover?
Involved?
Yeah. I mean, either positively or negatively, you know.
I joined the union of my own free will. And I could say I was a union man, but I didn't like some of the...
Did you go to branch meetings?
I used to, and then, as I say, it got political. And they used to say, well, you don't go to the branch meetings, it's up to you. But these people who were political-minded, they'd go to every branch meeting. And why they were going to these branch meetings, and most of them, well, I don't know, I suppose they're entitled to the feelings, they were communists or Trotskyites or... Which
yes, someone like Barker or Taffy Locke.
Oh yeah, you know about them. They'd gone by this time.
Or Pat Rock.
Yeah, Pat Rock. Yeah.
No, but you see, you're jumping in time because they weren't political in that.
No,
sense.
That's true. None of
so
them were.
It wasn't till Joe Harris' time, which
that's
is
right.
Until 70.
That's right.
Really, that changes.
Yeah,
because in the 60s.
They weren't political.
No. So
well, they were, but...
there must have been some.
There were some, but and it went further back than then. I reckon it started in 1953, I do.
With the McHugh?
That was the start of it, I think. I always did.
But you didn't get then together with people who said, we don't want this, let's try and do something about it? Or
I was,
I refused to pay my dues or something, or...
No,
you couldn't, of course, because you might have lost your job. But
it was close shop anyway, the Rover. But I used to go to the union meetings. When it was the National Union, you used to have to go. If you didn't go to the union meetings, you could get into trouble then, you know. You used to put your name down in the book that you'd attended a branch, and anyway, the shop stewards would have you. You know, you wasn't at the branch meeting, but when it became the Transport and General Workers Union, it was such a big thing that they wouldn't have missed it if you hadn't have gone. And a couple of times we went. I did go to one or two branch meetings, but as I say, it had gone political by then. And you'd got these, like you say, there wasn't the Taffy Locks and the Teddy Barkers and the Pat Rocks. I knew Pat Rock well.
He's still alive, isn't he?
Oh yes, he's still alive, Pat Rock. He wasn't. I knew him exceptionally well. I actually worked with him. He wasn't. He went more for. He'd have been the man for the pension scheme and getting
yes.
that thing sort
I
of thing.
He was, yes.
Or if he was ill, or if his wife had died, he'd look after you that way. On the things I wanted, that was the sort of thing I wanted. I didn't want this.
More political.
More political, where the union was trying to tell the government what to do. I didn't want that. I wanted them to look after my wages, and like I've said before, Pat Rock and Taffy Lock and Teddy Barker, they were, you know, more for looking after the working man as an individual, not as holding a card up in a conference saying I've got 3 million votes or what it was. And that's where I think the union went wrong. It had gone on. And that was about the same time as British Leyland took over. They built this in, and all these people moved into the motor car industry,
yes,
sir. Unknowns to us. You talk to a man, you don't know what his political views are.
Yes.
You don't find out that until years later when you've worked with him and he's trying to push something onto you that you don't want. And then I say at the Rover, it happened about 11 years ago. It was there before that, but it got really strong 11 years ago when the Leyland was formed.
Who was the, on the P5, who was the sort of main steward there? Do you remember that?
On the P5? Well, when I was at the end, well, to start with all, at the end.
Now both, if you remember.
Well, Pat Rock was the steward.
But he was overall, so...
He was over Land Rover, and he was the convener, the Rover convener, Pat Rock.
Didn't he work on Land Rover?
He worked on Land Rover.
Yeah, so...
He worked in...
The carman, or the P5?
Well, it'd be Taffy Lock. He was the senior steward. He was over the. He was on the car side, so he worked in the body shop, Taffy Lock. So he was very likely the senior steward over the car, and Pat Rock was the convener. And don't forget, the Land Rover was much bigger than the car side. There was more people employed on the Land Rover then than there was on the car side.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because their production was a lot bigger than
yes.
Ours. P5s, we used to, when it was in its heyday, we only used to build about 35 a day, where the Land Rover was doing virtually, say, 1,000 vehicles or more a week.
A week,
we
yes.
were doing something like 200 and something, or perhaps 300. So obviously, like, the main workforce was on the Land Rover.
Yes. And would you have a section steward, too?
Oh, we'd have section stewards.
What sort of people were those?
Our section steward, he was a fella called Dennis Brown. He was a bit of a hothead, but he wasn't...
Not political?
No, he wouldn't.
But did he stand up?
There was. We had plenty of little, as I say, flare-ups and strikes. We lost a lot of time in odd days and things like that.
So it was important to have a steward to argue about waiting time and that sort of
thing? Yes, we used to have the bonus system and waiting time and... what else used to come into it?
AFC.
God, that caused some trouble. And this is when you used to get these little strikes, but I'm convinced a lot of it was caused by the management to get you to walk out because the car park was full, like we're going back to... But we was always having...
Did you have meetings with
Dennis Brown?
Oh, we used
to have meetings, yeah. And
was that regular,
you said? Oh, yeah. Weekly, at least. There was once a week, sometimes once a day in the lunch. We used to have them in the lunch times. Or we'd
have
a walk out and go outside.